Imagine turning like a microscopic 3% change in the price of corn into this massive 35% return on your money. And doing that in a single afternoon.
Which is wild to even think about.
Right. It's the absolute superpower of futures leverage. But, you know, here's the terrifying flip side of that. If the market sneezes in the wrong direction,
Yeah.
you don't just lose a little cash. You can wipe out your entire account just as fast.
Yeah, it's not very forgiving.
Not at all. So today, we are doing the math on survival in the futures market. But before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Highly recommend them.
Yeah, they're great. All right, let's talk about turning a speculative futures position into cold, hard cash.
Yeah, we are taking the theoretical architecture of the market and making it incredibly tangible today. Because, if you are studying for this Series 3, you are looking at a unit that covers roughly 71% of your exam across the combined first seven chapters.
71%. That's
It's
huge.
massive. I mean, this isn't trivia. This is the engine room of the test.
Exactly. And I am talking directly to you, the listener, right now.
Yeah.
Your mission is to crush this exam. And to do that, you really need to understand how a trade translates to money in three distinct stages.
Right, the three stages.
So, first, the raw gross profit. Second, the net profit, which is, after the broker takes their cut. And third, the return on margin equity, which measures your actual win against the real skin you put in the game.
But I mean, formulas on a whiteboard are boring
So boring.
and they evaporate from your brain the second you sit down in that testing center. So
Yeah.
we need a way to anchor this math to reality.
Yeah, and to do that, we need to understand the psychology of the people actually executing these trades. And just to be clear, we are looking exclusively at speculators today.
Right, speculators, meaning they hold only futures.
Yes, no offsetting cash position. They are purely betting on price direction, which means, every single dollar of their final result comes down to clean, unforgiving arithmetic.
Which brings us to our two favorite market
I
participants.
love these two.
First, we have Corn Crazy Carl.
Good old Carl.
Carl is our eternal optimist. He is always wearing this, like, slightly wrinkled, bright yellow button-down shirt. He is sweating, he is vibrating with energy, and he always goes long.
He always goes long. He wakes up every single morning believing the price of corn is going to shoot straight to the moon.
Right. And operating in the exact same market, we have Bearish Betty.
The complete opposite.
Totally. Betty is the ultimate pessimist. She is wearing a pristine, sharp black suit, sitting in a dark office, sipping a double espresso. Betty always goes short. She looks at Carl's optimism and just laughs. She's essentially waiting to capitalize when prices crash and burn.
So Carl wants the elevator to go up, and Betty wants to get the cables.
Exactly.
But before they can count their winnings, they both have to calculate their gross profit or loss. So let's look at the mechanics of this first hurdle. We are talking about taking a raw price movement and figuring out what it actually means.
The baseline here is figuring out the difference between the entry price and the exit price, right?
Right. And then applying what I call the translation engine of the contract, and finally scaling it by the number of contracts held.
So let's start with Carl's perspective because it aligns with how we normally navigate the world. Carl is going long. He buys first. He inherently wants the price to rise.
Right. The math for a long position is entirely intuitive. It is your exit price minus your entry price.
Yeah.
I mean, if Carl buys a contract at $4 and a week later the market rallies and he sells it at $5, the math is just 5 minus 4.
Super simple. The result is a positive one. He has a favorable move.
It is the classic buy low, sell high philosophy we've all known since we were kids, setting up lemonade stands.
Yeah, exactly.
But then we pivot to Bearish Betty. And this is where brains tend to short circuit a little bit.
Oh, totally.
Betty goes short. She sells first, and she wants the price to fall. Wait, let me pause right here and play the confused student for a second.
Go for it.
So Betty wants the number on the ticker screen to go down to make money. I mean, my entire life, I've been conditioned to believe that green arrows pointing up mean profit and red arrows pointing down mean tragedy. How does a dropping price equal profit?
Yeah, it's counterintuitive at first. It requires a fundamental shift in how you view ownership. Think about the mechanical timeline of what Betty is actually executing in the market.
Okay, lay it out.
Betty is selling a contract she does not currently own at today's high price, but she is making a legally binding promise to buy that exact same contract back at some point in the future to close the loop and settle her debt to the market.
So she is effectively selling an IOU.
Yes, exactly. She is taking in cash today for an obligation she has to fulfill tomorrow. If she sells that obligation at a high price, she takes in a lot of capital right now.
Right.
But to fulfill the obligation, she has to go into the market later and buy it back. She desperately wants the cost of fulfilling that obligation to be cheap.
So she sold high and she needs to buy back low.
Exactly. Therefore, the mathematical subtraction for a short position flips entirely. It becomes your entry price minus your exit price, the money you collected at the top minus the money you spent at the bottom to close the trade.
Okay, I want to stop and test you, the listener, right now. Put your coffee down or, stop walking for 2 seconds and actually think about this. If Betty sells a futures contract at 460 and a week later she buys it back at 448, is she celebrating or is she crying?
Give them a second to think.
Yeah. Is it a win or a loss?
Yeah.
She is celebrating. That is a win. For a short trader, down equals dollars in their pocket.
And that is the reflex you have to build. I mean, when the timer is ticking on the Series 3, you don't have time to philosophize about the nature of short selling. You need a mechanical anchor.
Here is your anchor. I want you to write this on the inside of your eyelids. Long up, short down. I'll repeat it. Long up, short down.
It's that simple.
A long trader wants the price to climb, so you subtract exit minus entry. A short trader wants the price to drop, so you subtract entry minus exit. You basically always arrange the subtraction so that the market moving in their preferred direction generates a positive number.
And let's call out an exam trap right here. The exam writers know this is a cognitive friction point.
Oh, they love testing this.
They really do. They will lay a trap designed specifically to exploit your natural inclination that up is always good. They will give you a scenario where a trader is short, the market price rallies significantly, and they will ask you for the gross profit.
And if you aren't paying attention to the directionality,
Right, you will see the price went up. Calculate the difference and select a positive profit answer. You have to recognize instantly that a higher buyback price for a short position is a devastating loss.
right. I mean, if Betty sells at 460 and is forced to buy back at 480, she collected 460 but had to spend 480 to get out. That is a 20-cent bleed.
Exactly.
But, this brings us to a massive structural reality of the futures market. A 20-cent move is not $20. I mean, if Carl makes a 15-cent profit on his corn trade and struts into a Ferrari dealership slapping three nickels on the desk, security is going to escort him to the sidewalk.
Yeah, he's walking home. Which is why the raw price difference is utterly useless until it passes through the contract multiplier.
A magic
The
only.
multiplier is the translation engine. And, to understand why we have this, you have to look at the history and purpose of the exchanges, like the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Right, their primary mandate is liquidity.
Exactly. They want thousands of anonymous buyers and sellers to be able to trade instantly without ever talking to each other.
Imagine the nightmare if they didn't do this. Like, Carl wants to buy corn, and he has to go into a trading pit and yell, "I want to buy 3,214 bushels." And someone else yells, "Well, I only want to sell 1,800 bushels."
There would be chaos.
They would have to stop, negotiate the volume, figure out the pricing for that specific weird volume, and then, like, draw up a custom contract.
Yeah.
The market would just grind to a halt.
It would be wildly inefficient. So the exchange steps in and creates a standardized unit. They say, look, if you want to trade corn here, one single contract will always represent exactly 5,000 bushels, no exception.
No exceptions.
Right. Because the volume is locked, the exchange can establish a fixed multiplier to convert a single unit of price movement into a standardized dollar amount per contract.
So, walk us through the math of that translation engine for corn specifically.
Sure. Corn is quoted in cents per bushel. If the price moves by one single cent, you have to remember that move applies to all 5,000 bushels inside that contract. 1 cent is $0.01. If you multiply 1 cent by 5,000, you get exactly $50. Therefore, a 1 cent price move in corn translates to 50 real dollars per contract.
Okay, and this isn't just for agriculture, right?
Yeah.
It applies to financials, energies, metals, everything.
The underlying architecture is identical everywhere. Take the E-mini S&P 500 contract. The exchange dictates that the contract size is $50 times the index.
Okay.
So if the S&P 500 index moves one full point, that translates to $50 per contract. A 10-point move is $500. The mechanism of scaling price to dollars is the same, only the underlying commodity changes.
Let me flag the biggest exam trap regarding the multiplier right here.
Yeah, this is a big one.
The exam writers love to bury the multiplier in a wall of distractor text. Like, they might give you a paragraph talking about adverse weather patterns in Iowa, the historical export rate of soybeans, and then casually drop the contract size in the middle of a sentence.
They love doing that.
Or worse, they might give you mismatched units. They might quote the price in dollars, but give you a multiplier based on cents. You have to be hypervigilant about the sequence. You always find the raw price subtraction first, ensure your units match, and then run it through the translation engine.
Okay, let's pull Carl back into the picture and put this sequence into practice. Let's see what a winning trade actually looks like on his ledger.
Okay, Carl is having a great week. He buys one single corn contract at 420 cents per bushel. The weather report shows a drought, the market panics, prices rally, and a few days later, Carl sells to close his position at 435 cents.
All right, we run the protocol. Step one, price direction. He's long, so we take the exit minus the entry. 435 minus 420, the market moved 15 cents in his favor.
Step two, the translation engine. We know the multiplier for corn is $50 per 1 cent move. So we take his 15 cent move and multiply it by $50. 15 times 50 gives us $750.
And step three, scale by the number of contracts. Carl's a cautious guy today. He only traded one contract. $750 times one is $750. That is his gross profit.
Beautiful. Now let's look at bearish Betty. She doesn't do anything small. She trades in volume.
Of course she does.
Betty looks at the same market and decides it's heavily overvalued. She steps in and sells three corn contracts short at 460 cents. But the drought turns out to be a false alarm. A massive storm system rolls in. Crop yields look amazing. And the price of corn plummets. Betty buys back all three contracts at 448 cents to close out her position.
We follow the exact same protocol. Step one, price direction. She is short, so we want the price to fall. Entry minus exit. She sold at 460. She bought back at 448. That is a favorable drop of 12 cents.
Step two, the translation engine. 12 cents times the $50 multiplier. 12 times 50 equals $600. Now we have a $600 gross profit per contract.
And step three is critical here. This is where we scale by the number of contracts, and I want to emphasize that this must always be the last step in your gross profit calculation. Betty traded three contracts. We take that $600 per contract profit, multiply it by three, and we arrive at $1,800 of total gross profit.
Hold on, let me stop you right there, because I know someone listening is wondering about the order of operations.
Uh-huh.
What happens if I try to be clever and multiply the 12-cent move by the three contracts first, and then apply the multiplier? Okay, I still get $1,800 at the end. Why does the order matter?
Because it corrupts your understanding of market reality, and the exam will use that against you.
Oh, so?
If you multiply 12 cents by three contracts, you get 36 cents. Then you multiply 36 cents by $50, and yes, you arrive at $1,800. But mathematically, you are telling yourself the market moved 36 cents.
Right.
The market did not move 36 cents, it moved 12. If the exam asks a multi-part question, and part A is, what is the profit per contract? You have already destroyed your baseline number. You will look at your scratch pad, see 36 cents, run the multiplier, and get the wrong per contract answer. You must lock in the dollar value for one single contract first, then scale the volume.
Hey, wake up. Listen to me. Did you catch that? A price change on your screen is not dollars until it passes through that translation engine. If you forget the multiplier on the exam, you are going to look at the multiple choice answers. You're going to see $12 sitting there as an option. You will click it and you will fail that question.
It's a guaranteed trap.
Find the price change, translate to dollars, scale by contracts. That is the holy trinity of gross profit.
And while Carl and Bede might be staring at those gross profit numbers, feeling pretty good about themselves, they haven't actually cleared the friction of the market yet.
Oh, no.
Because the exchange and the brokers, they are not running a charity.
Which brings us to the next hurdle. Carl has his $750 in gross profit. He is unbuttoning his yellow shirt. He is looking up steakhouses on his phone. He is ready to celebrate. But as he tries to leave his trading platform, the broker is standing there in the doorway with their hand out.
Yep. Enter commissions.
We have to talk about net profit, which means navigating the round turn commission.
Right, because gross profit is an illusion. Net profit is what you can actually withdraw to your bank account. It is the gross result minus the transaction costs. And the primary transaction cost in futures is the commission.
The toll booth.
Exactly. And the exam presses relentlessly on your understanding of how and when this commission is applied.
You are going to see the phrase round turn constantly on the test. I mean, think about booking a trip to Las Vegas. When you go online to buy your flight, you don't purchase a ticket for the plane to fly to Nevada. And then after a weekend of bad decisions, go to a different airline counter to negotiate a second separate ticket to fly home.
Right. You buy one round trip fare up front.
Yes. It covers the departure and it covers the return.
And the round turn commission operates on the exact same logic. It is a single bundled fee that covers the complete life cycle of a single futures contract. It pays the broker for opening the position, the entry, and it pays the broker for closing the position at the exit.
It is one cost for the entire round trip.
So predictably, the exam is going to try to trick you into double counting it.
Oh, always.
They will present a scenario where Carl buys a contract and they will tell you the round turn commission is $50. Then they will describe Carl selling the contract 2 weeks later to close the position. The trap is hoping you subtract $50 on the buy leg and another $50 on the sell leg.
But you only subtract it once per contract. Now, there is a minor caveat you need to be prepared for, right?
Yes. On rare occasions, a question might quote a per side commission instead of a round turn.
Okay, so how does that work?
Well, a round turn obviously has two sides, the entry and the exit. If the exam explicitly states the broker charges $25 per side, you simply double it to find your $50 round turn cost. But the round turn quote is the industry standard. Just, you know, read the phrasing deliberately.
Read the phrasing. Okay, let's look at the math on Carl's winning trade. His gross profit from the 15-cent corn rally was $750. His broker charges a standard $50 round turn commission per contract. Carl only traded one contract. So the math is beautifully simple.
Right, $750 gross minus the $50 toll booth leaves Carl with a $700 net profit. He still gets his stake.
But the math gets significantly more psychologically punishing when the trade goes against you.
Yeah, let's explore that darkness.
What if Carl's optimism betrayed him? Let's say he buys corn at 420 expecting a rally. Instead, the weather is perfect, a massive harvest comes in, and the price tanks to 416. He panics and sells to close. He lost 4 cents.
Ouch.
We run that through the multiplier. 4 cents times $50 is a $200 gross loss. Here's my question for you, the listener. Does the broker look at Carl's $200 loss, feel a pang of sympathy, and waive the $50 commission?
Give him a beep.
Absolutely not. The broker executed the trades, the broker provided the access, the broker gets paid.
The market is entirely indifferent to your success or failure. Carl has a gross loss of negative $200. He still owes the $50 round turn commission. Mathematically, it is negative 200 minus 50. His net loss balloons to negative $250.
This highlights what I call the nibbling trap, and it is a massive student misconception. Human psychology frames a commission as a tax on success. We subconsciously think, oh, I made a profit, so the broker nibbles a little bit off the top. We think of it as something that only shrinks a gain.
And test writers prey on that psychological bias. If you view a commission purely as a reduction of profit, you will instinctively try to use it to reduce a loss, which is mathematically disastrous.
A commission shrinks a gain, yes, but it enlarges a loss. If you are already bleeding money from a terrible trade, the commission is a shark in the water coming to take another bite out of you.
Right. It always, without exception, pushes your final net result in the negative direction.
So if your gross profit is negative 200, do not let the exam trick you into adding the $50 commission back so your loss looks like a softer $150. You owe the market 200. You owe the broker 50. You are out $250.
It is a rigid mechanical rule. Every single cost of doing business exacerbates a losing position.
All right. So Carl has his $700 net profit from his good trade. He survived the toll booth. But, you know, $700 out of context doesn't actually tell us if Carl is a brilliant trader or just a guy who got lucky with a massive bankroll.
No, it doesn't.
To figure out the efficiency of the trade, we have to face the final boss of this unit, return on margin equity.
Net profit is the raw cash outcome. But return on margin equity tells you how hard your capital was actually working. It measures the velocity of your money.
The formula for this is deceptively simple. It's return on margin equity equals your net profit divided by the initial margin deposited.
But the denominator in that equation, the initial margin deposited, is the single most misunderstood concept by people migrating from the stock market to the futures market.
Oh, absolutely.
It requires unlearning what you know about securities trading. When you trade stocks on margin under Regulation T, you are literally borrowing money from your broker.
Yeah.
If you want to buy $100,000 worth of stock, but you only have $50,000 in cash, the broker loans you the other $50,000. Because it is a loan, the broker charges you interest every single day you hold that position. It is a financing arrangement.
That makes total sense for stocks.
Mm-hmm.
But if Carl puts up margin to buy a corn futures contract, isn't he just borrowing money to control all that corn?
No. And this is the foundational difference. Futures margin is not a down payment, and it is absolutely not a loan. It is a performance bond.
I love that phrase, performance bond. But let's break it down with an analogy. Think about renting a high-end apartment. When you sign the lease, the landlord makes you hand over a $2,000 security deposit.
Right.
The landlord is not loaning you the value of the apartment building. They're holding your cash as a good faith guarantee. If you act responsibly and don't punch holes in the drywall, you get the deposit back. If you trash the place, they seize the deposit to cover the damages.
And that is exactly how the futures clearinghouse views margin. The clearinghouse is the ultimate counterparty to every trade, which means they hold the systemic risk. They don't know Carl. They don't trust Carl.
I don't blame him, honestly.
Yeah, right. So they demand a good faith security deposit to ensure Carl has enough financial buffer to cover daily price fluctuations and fulfill his contractual obligation. Because no money is being borrowed to finance the purchase of an asset. Remember, Carl hasn't actually bought physical corn. He just entered a contract about corn there is no loan.
Which leads to the golden rule of futures margin.
Oh.
Because there is no loan, no interest is charged.
I cannot emphasize that enough. Unlike securities margin, where a financing cost constantly erodes your net profit over time, futures margin just sits in your account as collateral.
And the exam writers are going to test your conviction on this. They will give you a beautiful, complex word problem. They will give you Carl's entry price, exit price, the multiplier, the commission, and the margin deposit. And right at the end, they will throw in a sentence like, assume an annualized margin financing rate of 5%.
They are fishing to see if you bite.
They want you to try and calculate a prorated interest charge and subtract it from the net profit. Do you take the bait? No. You laugh at the screen, you ignore the distractor, and you use your clean net profit.
It is pure noise designed to punish students who conflate equities with commodities. Now, let's look at why traders are so obsessed with this return on margin equity calculation. It exposes a sheer power of leverage.
Let's pull Carl's winning trade back up and run the final numbers on this. We established his net profit after commissions was $700. Let's assume the exchange requires an initial margin deposit of $2,000 to open one corn contract. So Carl wired $2,000 of his own cash into his brokerage account.
We execute the formula, net profit divided by initial margin deposited. We take $700 and divide it by $2,000. That equals 0.35, which is a 35% return on margin equity.
35%. He made 35% on his money in a matter of days. If you tell a mutual fund manager you made 35% on a trade this week, they will faint.
They really would.
But we have to look at the other set of numbers here, because the exam is going to offer you a very tempting alternative denominator. Let's calculate the full notional value of the contract Carl was controlling.
The notional value is the actual market worth of the underlying asset. Carl bought the contract at 420 cents, which is $4.20 per bushel. The standardized contract dictates 5,000 bushels.
Okay.
If we multiply $4.20 by $5,000, we find that Carl is legally controlling $21,000 worth of physical corn.
$21,000, but he only had to put up $2,000 to do it. That is roughly 10 to 1 leverage. Now, here's the exam trick. If you divide Carl's $700 profit by the full $21,000 notional value of the contract, what do you get?
You get approximately 3.3%, which is a realistic, boring return for a normal, unleveraged financial transaction.
Okay, stop and think, listener. The exam asks you for the return on margin equity. The scenario gives you the $2,000 margin requirement, and it explicitly tells you the full contract value is $21,000. Which number goes on the bottom of your fraction?
With
the $2,000, return on margin, it is right there in the name. Do not let the massive notional value distract you. I guarantee you, 3.3% will be sitting there as option A on the multiple choice list. The exam wants you to second guess the massive 35% return because it feels suspiciously high.
But that suspiciously high number is the entire mechanical purpose of the futures market. The exchange allows you to control a massive asset with a tiny deposit. Because the deposit is so small, any price movement is radically amplified relative to the capital you deployed.
To make sure we have completely insulated you against the exam's tricks, we are going to run the master scenario.
The final boss fight.
Exactly. We're going to put all three stages together, gross, net, and return, using Bearish Betty's multi-contract short trade. This is the exact profile of a high-difficulty exam question.
Let's lock in Betty's variables. She shorted three corn contracts at an entry price of 460 cents. She bought them back at an exit price of 448 cents. The translation engine, the multiplier, is $50 per cent. The round-turn commission is $50 by contract, and the initial margin requirement is $2,000 per contract.
Stage one, gross profit. Betty is short. She wants the price to fall. entry minus exit, 460 minus 448 gives us a 12 cent favorable move.
Nice.
We run that through the translation engine. 12 cents times the $50 multiplier is a $600 gross profit per contract. Now we scale by volume. She holds three contracts. 600 times three is $1,800 of total gross profit.
That brings us to stage two, net profit. We have to pay the toll booth. The round turn commission is $50 per contract. Because she traded three contracts, we multiply the commission. 50 times three is a total transaction cost of $150.
Why?
We take her $1,800 gross profit, subtract the $150 commission once, and we arrive at a net profit of $1,650.
Stage three, return on margin equity. We need to find our total initial margin deposit. The requirement is $2,000 per contract. She is holding three contracts, which means she had to wire a total of $6,000 to the clearinghouse as her performance bond. We take her net profit of $1,650 and divide it by her $6,000 total deposit. 1,650 divided by 6,000 equals 0.275, or a 27.5% return.
And the profound takeaway here is how multi-contract math scales with perfect symmetry. Look at the numbers. If Betty had only traded a single contract, her net profit would have been $550 derived from a single $2,000 margin deposit. If you divide 550 by 2,000, you still get exactly 27.5%.
Wait, that is a phenomenal realization. The return percentage does not change based on volume. Three contracts triple the raw profit, they triple the commission cost, and they triple the required margin deposit, but the ratio remains perfectly identical.
It acts as an incredible built-in safety net during the exam. If you calculate the percentage for the multi-contract position and it doesn't perfectly match the single contract percentage, you have made a mechanical error. You either forgot the multiplier or you forgot to scale the commissions across all the contracts.
All right, pattern interrupt. We are shifting gears into the synthesis phase. I want you to visualize a mental whiteboard. We are going to distill everything we just tore apart into four unbreakable rules.
The rapid fire recap.
Yes. These are the concepts you need to be able to recite in your sleep before you walk into the testing center.
We can anchor the entire mathematical architecture on these four pillars.
Pillar one, the directionality reflex. Long up, short down. If a trader goes short, like Betty, they only profit when the price falls. You calculate their move by subtracting the exit price from the entry price. Don't let a rising price on a short position trick you into calculating a profit.
Pillar two, the translation engine. A price change in cents or ticks is meaningless until it is converted to dollars. Always apply the exchange's fixed contract multiplier to the raw price move before you scale up by the number of contracts. Lock in the single contract value first.
Pillar three, the toll booth. Round turn commissions cover the whole trip, the entry, and the exit. You only subtract them one CE per contract. And crucially, remember the shark in the water. Commissions shrink your gains, but they absolutely enlarge your losses. They always push your net result further into the negative.
Pillar four, the performance bond. Return on margin equity uses your actual cash deposit as the denominator, not the massive notional value of the contract. And because it is a good faith deposit and not a loan, you never, ever subtract margin interest.
If you burn those four pillars into your brain, the math questions on the series three become automatic. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to step away from the exam mechanics for a second and leave you with a real world reality check.
A provocative thought to end on?
Yeah. We spent an hour marveling at the magic of leverage. We watched Carl turn a tiny 15-cent move in the price of corn into a staggering 35% return on his money. It feels like a license to print money.
It is an incredibly intoxicating concept when the math works in your favor. But you have to remember that mathematical formulas are entirely agnostic. They have no empathy. They work with the exact same brutal efficiency in reverse.
Think about the alternative timeline. If Carl's trade had gone against him by that exact same small amount, if corn prices had just hiccuped in the wrong direction for 2 days, he wouldn't have just suffered a minor setback. He would have instantly wiped out 35% of his entire margin deposit.
Which is terrifying.
A few bad days in a highly leveraged environment doesn't just hurt. It triggers margin calls, forced liquidations, and account death. Leverage is a superpower, but the leverage doesn't care if you are the hero of the story or the tragic cautionary tale.
It acts purely as an amplifier of reality. This is the existential core of futures trading. It dictates why institutional risk management is so draconian.
If you know that a 4 cent move can devour a massive chunk of your capital, you don't trade on hope. You trade with hard stop losses, and you know exactly where your exit door is before you ever walk into the room. Understanding that mathematical violence is what separates the gamblers throwing darts from the professionals managing risk. You are now armed with the mechanics. Keep grinding through those CertFuel practice exams, respect the math, and we will catch you in the next deep dive.